All right, it's time for a legend, sir.
Yes, it is indeed. He's the legendary head coach of the Michigan Wolverines, someone we've talked to a number of times on this podcast. He is one of the great storytellers slash head coaches in the game. He is on his way to Grand Rapids, I understand, for the Mike Knuebel induction of the Grand Rapids Sports Hall of Fame. He is the one and only Red Berenson. Red, good of you to be aboard today. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you guys? Where are you, by the way?
Well, I'm in Stouffville, a little bit north of Toronto, and Greg's studio is in. Are you in Manhattan, Wish? Where are you in New York?
I am in the city that never sleeps, except if it's watching the Rangers. Sometimes I'm in beautiful New York City, and Red, let's start off with Mike Knuebel, one of my single favorite players. Tell us about your love for the immovable object of the National Hockey League, Mike Knuebel.
Well, when I first saw Mike, he was playing for the Kalamazoo Junior team, and they were in the North American League, and you could see that he had the body, and he had the hands for a big kid, and his skating was something that would improve over time, but he was just one of those players. He loved to hit, and he loved to shoot. And as I got to know him, I realized what a fine kid this is. He's not just a kind of a rough around the edges player. He's a good student. He's well spoken. He's a gentleman, and so on. So I was quick to recruit him. And he'd been out of high school for 1 year, I believe, that year. And he played in his hometown high school up until then. But he turned out to be a terrific player and a great ambassador for any team he played on, not just Michigan, but when he went on to the NHL. And he was with Detroit for 2 years. And I remember telling Scotty Bowman, you've got to play this guy. You know, he's not getting an opportunity to play with good players because he's going to make a career out of playing well with good players. And he did that when he finally got a shot. I think it was in Boston, playing with top players, and then again in Philadelphia and so on, everywhere he went. But a terrific kid. We had one incident with Mike, and he had a racing heart between periods, and we couldn't get it to stop, and we rushed him to the hospital. And the heart doctor did he did all the tests on him, and he came back to me and he said, you know, I think Mike's going to have to retire from hockey. He's got an enlarged heart.
Wow.
And I said, geez, I don't want to tell you what to do, but would you mind checking, like take two of our other players just randomly and check them? And because I think all hockey players have enlarged hearts, at least that's what I'd heard. And sure enough, he came back and said, you're right, you know, we'll just monitor him, and well, the rest is history. Wow. I mean, Mike's career nearly came to an end, and his dad, unfortunately, died when he was jogging one morning from a heart attack, and as a young man. So, a lot of history with Mike, but what a great kid, and I'm glad they're recognizing him in his hometown.
Did you ever see him play at East Kentwood High? Because he set records there, like shattered records that I think still stand to this day.
Right. I think our assistant coach saw him play there, and you're right. I mean, he was a man amongst boys in high school.
That's interesting stuff. Hey, Red, your Michigan team recently played BU. It was a game in which it seemed like every time the puck went in the net or near the net, there was a video review. It's one of those nights. I wanted to get your take on video review. You said something after the game along the lines of, hey, how did we ever survive without it, in sort of a sarcastic way. Do you like it as a fail-safe, or do you wish that maybe we didn't implement it as much as we do?
Well, you know, I like the idea that we're trying to get it right. I mean, that may not have come across in the interview, but do we have to interview every goal or review every goal? And if we do, we should have the equipment, and we should have the sense of urgency to do it now. You know, when a goal is scored, it's one of the most exciting parts of the game. Mm-hmm. And the crowd's into it, the teams are into it, and, you know, one is more excited than the other, obviously, but it's a big part of the game. Well, then you just take everything right out. You take all the excitement out of the building because you take 5 or even 10 minutes to try and get it right. Well, at one point in this game, then the first review, the referee stood in there for at least 5 minutes. So the linesman came over, and I said, what's the problem? He said, well, they can't, there's no picture on the monitor. are you kidding? Well, what's he looking at then? You know, it was, anyway, it was, and it was just one of those games where the reviews that, you know, the goal that we scored was called back, but all the other ones were counted. And I never did get the whole story on the review. But nevertheless, I think they take up too much time. Like, you want to get it right, but let's make a good decision on this quickly. And I would also say that don't just put the referee in the box. Like, the way we do it is a lot different than the NHL. The NHL puts it in the hands of Toronto. And those people sit there, and they haven't made a call one way or the other. But if I'm the referee on the ice and I make the call and I go out of my way to exaggerate, this is a good goal, and then I go in the box and I have to turn it over, I'd rather the other guy go in there and say, oh, geez, we made a mistake and it's no goal. Mm-hmm. So, we had that happen in the NCAA tournament one year. The one referee stood in there for 10 minutes, and I finally got the other referee to go in there with him and help him, and sure enough, within 30 seconds, it was called a good goal, but the one just didn't want to call it a good goal for whatever reason. So it's not always perfect.
Brett, if you can indulge me for a couple of seconds, I want to ask you some questions about coaching, about the Soviet Union, and about 1972. You played a couple of games in that 72 series, the crucial Game 6, where the referee wanted to fill the box, speaking of penalties, fill the box with Canadians. You set up Cornoyer, beautiful goal, Canada wins 3-2. But correct me if I'm wrong, were you the only player on that 72 team to have faced a Soviet hockey team previous, going back to 59 with the World Championships and the Belleville McFarlanes?
Boy, I think so. There might have been a couple of players like Savard and Cornway might have played against the Soviets, one of the Soviet teams, when they were playing for the junior Canadians.
Right.
But as far as playing the top team in a situation like this, I may have been the only one. That's a good call. That was in 59, the spring of 59.
Yeah, the Belleville McFarlanes, and you led that tournament. Goals, points, Canada won on goal differential. That 1959 Belleville. I think Mark Crawford's dad played on that team, I want to say.
Yeah, with the Crawfords. Floyd Crawford was
That's
the,
it, yeah.
He was on that team, and and they had some former pro players on that team, and they had got their amateur cards back, like Al Dewsbury and one of the Conachers was on that team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was picked up. I was actually playing at Michigan in my first year at Michigan, and Belleville, Billy Ray had been fired as the Maple Leafs coach, and Belleville had hired him to try and to build up the Belleville team. They could add two or three players, and so I think they got myself, Conacher, and a Bobby. He was a good French hockey player from Quebec, but they picked up a few of us to add to the team, to bolster
now,
the team. From the previous year, they'd won the Allen Cup.
Right, for senior men's hockey. The question that I have, given your when you played. Experience playing against the Soviet Union, 59 the World Championships, the pair of games, and then obviously the bird's eye view for the rest of the games in 1972. Fred Shiro always talked about learning a lot from Anatoly Tarasov and the Soviet system. And, you know, Anatoly Tarasov would say, you know what, I watch games and I count passes, and I always find the team that makes the most passes ends up winning the game. The Soviet style became all about passing. As a head coach, did any of that soak in for you? Were you in any way influenced from a coaching point of view by the Soviet system you played against a few times?
Well, I don't know if I didn't know at the time I was going to be a coach, obviously, but I would say yes, some of it. I mean, the skill level that they showed, even in 1959 in the World Tournament, was something that showed up again in 72. You know, they had exceptional skills, all their players. It wasn't just two or three players. I mean, their defensemen handled the puck just like they were the leading scorer on the team. And they joined the rush, and they shot the puck on their offhand better than we did over here, and so on and so forth. So I remember all that. But you're right, their puck control was as good as it gets. And we had to play our style, which didn't always mesh with their style. But we beat them 3-1 in a real hard-fought hockey game in Prague. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Prague in those days was they were anti-Russia or communism, and so they were, all the fans were cheering for Canada.
Yeah.
But when the Russians played Prague, boy, yeah. It was like a war. I mean, you could sense the serious political undertones back then.
Well, and even to this day, Jaromir Jagr wears number 68, the year that the tanks rolled in to then Czechoslovakia. And you're right, those world championships in like 68 and 69, I mean, the Czechoslovakian Soviet games were, I mean, they made the Oilers and the Flames of the 80s look like a walk in the park. One more follow-up on 72, Red, and then we'll move on, I swear. I remember talking to Ron Ellis once, just about style of play, and Ron said, listen, you know, we were a group of, you know, players that, you know, weren't in shape yet for the season. We used to treat training camp as a way to get in shape. You know, we were winded after games. It was a tired team. And Ron made this point. He said, if Russia would have played a Canadian style of dump and chase, they probably would have beaten us because by the end, we would have been too exhausted to do anything. Do you think Ron Ellis was right or wrong?
Well, at the start of the tournament, there's no question that, you know, this, remember, we started in early September, and
yep.
So we had had what you'd call a training camp in Toronto, and Harry Sinden was our coach, and John Ferguson was assistant coach, but they brought in over 30 players to play on this Team Canada team, and mm-hmm. and typically they were the best players from around the league and from their teams and so on, but we had no one to play against except each other. So as much as we worked hard and we trained and everything, we had no game conditioning except just this inner squad scrimmages that we had. And we thought we were ready. And I think the first 5 minutes or the first period in Montreal showed that we were ready. But we weren't ready for a full game, like a real stop and start and high-intensity hockey. And we needed to get into game shape. And it's embarrassing to say that now because teams are in much better game shape in training camp than they were in those days, but that's the way it was. And so all these players had taken the month of August out of their summer to train with Team Canada, but once the game started, and it was, you could tell, I mean, we just didn't have the legs or the endurance,
yeah.
And they were in mid-season form. I mean, they were flying. But after four games, and we didn't get a lot better as those games went on. I mean, you saw the Winnipeg game was tied,
yep.
And the Vancouver game, we got beat bad. And the poor coaching staff, they're trying to throw new players in to refresh our lineup. But that didn't help because they weren't in any better shape than the guys that were playing. And so finally we went to Sweden the next week, and we continued to practice and play exhibition games against the Swedes. And by the time we got to Russia, we were much closer to being in somewhat better condition, and it started to show. And we led the first game. I think we were up 4-2 in the game going in the third period, and they came back and beat us. And but that was the first inkling that I had that we could beat that team. And
quick,
no matter
quick.
What system we were playing, even though we're playing now on the Olympic rink, which was a bigger rink, we had more legs and we had more game instincts and game sharpness than we had when we started that tournament. So
you know,
the Russians had the edge on conditioning, but we got caught up, and then it was a series.
There's a story floating out there. You can confirm or shoot it down, Red, that when you guys got to Sweden, there was a moment which involved a park in Sweden somewhere, a case of beer, and Phil Esposito sort of having a heart-to-heart with all the players from Team Canada. Is that accurate or not?
Geez, I don't know. I don't remember that. I mean, there's a lot of things about that whole experience that people bring up even today, and I'll say, geez, I don't remember that, you know, whether I was involved in that or not.
Right.
There were so many things that happened, but I don't remember that.
Yeah.
But I do remember the team got closer. I mean, we got closer socially. We got closer as a team on the ice. The players that weren't playing, you know, that weren't necessarily happy because they're used to being leaders on their teams, accepted their roles. And so we got, you know, we became more of a team than we were when we started the tournament.
And there were guys that left. I mean, the Rangers wanted their guys back. The Punch Imlach wanted the Sabres guys back. Like, guys left.
Yeah, guys left, and it was too bad, you know. I can't tell you that, you know, if people put themselves in that situation. I mean, these are proud guys. And, you know, Vic Hadfield scored 50 goals that year.
Yep.
Playing with Rattel and Gilbert, and they took him off that line for one reason or another, and they put Mahovlich on the line, and Vic just, you know, he was a proud guy, and he couldn't handle that at the time. But I'll say this for Vic Hadfield. He comes to every reunion we have. The team embraces him. I mean, he's still
great.
Part of the team. So he's been well accepted by the players, even though at the time, you know, he was a defector.
Cool. Greg, thanks for indulging me in my questions with Red from 72. Go ahead, Greg.
I know when to just hand the mic to you and go and get coffee. Hey, Red, two questions about the NCAA. First off, Big Ten Hockey Conference. I think this is year two for you guys. What are the benefits and drawbacks so far from a Michigan perspective playing in this conference?
Well, I think the benefits are that we're playing like schools. You know, like we're a big university, and we're in the Big Ten Conference. All our sports play in the Big Ten Conference: basketball, football, baseball, track and field, you name it. We've got 31 sports, and they all play against the Big Ten, except hockey. And until last year, hockey was playing in what they called the CCHA, and we'd play other schools that weren't in our conference, and for the most part, smaller schools. So now we're playing like schools, and I think it's great. So we play home and home with every school in the Big Ten, and it's been a win-win, I think, for the conference. The disadvantage is that we don't get to see some of the smaller schools that we played before for one reason or another, and they're all in different conferences now. And we may or may not play them. On the other hand, we only play 20 of our 34 games in the Big Ten, so we've been able to play some of the non-conference opponents, like Boston University. We just went out there and played them, and we played Lowell, and we played New Hampshire, and so we're going to go out and play Boston College. So we're getting a chance to play some of the other conference big schools as well. So I think that's a win-win overall for us.
And then finally for me, Red, you and I are both obviously huge fans of NCAA hockey. We want nothing but American college hockey dominance all over North America. Please tell me why Jack Eichel will end up being a better player than Connor McDavid.
Well, I like the fact, like, we just played against Eichel, and I like the fact that his development, I haven't seen the other kid, and you know, he could be the real deal as well, but Eichel is doing it the right way. You know, if he were my son, I'd want him in school. If he were my son, I'd want him in the weight room with people that know what they're doing, and in a serious program with structure. And if he were my son, I'd want him playing against the best players available. And he's playing against kids that are 22, 23 years old. And where if you're playing junior hockey, the oldest player you'll play is a 20-year-old. And so the players in the university are stronger, they're older, stronger, and they don't play as many games, but when they play, they're intense games. If you saw the game that we played BU the other night, I mean, that was a back-and-forth game, and Eichel stood out in that game, and I can tell you he's going to be a real player.
And lastly from me, Red, and this involves a question about recruiting. And for my entire adult life, you have been one of, if not the finest recruiter in all of NCAA. I do want to ask you, though, and you very famously turned down a $16,000 contract from the Montreal Canadiens because you wanted to finish your education at Michigan. But there are some players who you know they're just going to go to Michigan or to wherever for one, maybe 2 years. You know they're going to leave early. And you've seen this before. It's happened before the Wolverines, happened to all NCAA teams. Have you ever been at the point where you say to yourself, I shouldn't even bother recruiting someone that I know is only going to be here for one, maybe 2 years? Or do you say to yourself, Red, you know what? It's my responsibility to ice the best hockey team. And if we only have them for 1 or 2 years, so be it. I want them on the Wolverines. Where are you at with that?
Well, I'll tell you where I'm at. I think it's great that a kid has a dream to play in the NHL, and I would never want to get in the way of that. But I've always felt that there's life after hockey as well. and everyone doesn't get to live that dream. There's a small percentage of kids that play major junior hockey that are ever going to make a living in the NHL, and it's about the same percentage of kids that are in my locker room at Michigan that are going to make a living in the NHL. But the one thing I can tell you that all our kids are going to graduate. Now, there's going to be a few exceptional players, the first-rounders that get signed early that leave early. And some of those kids might not ever come back, but a lot of them do. And we just graduated two kids in the last year that one of them played in the NHL for some time. I won't tell you who it is, but I can tell you Mike Komisarek was in my office yesterday. He flew up here from Florida, and he's re-enrolling in school. And he was a first-round pick with Montreal, and he played 2 years. He was an All-American here, and then Montreal signed him. So he's got 2 years left in school, but he's coming back to go to school. Had Michael not come to school for at least 1 year or two, he would have never been coming back at age 32 wanting to get his degree. And I think that's terrific. So he's going to have a career after hockey. And it's just like Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson comes back every summer, and he's pretty close to graduating now. And that was important to him and his family.
How speaking of Jack Johnson, that's a pretty famous story where Jim Rutherford wanted to turn him pro with Carolina, and he said, no, I'm not going to walk out on the Wolverines and Red Barons. What was that? Take us back to that time with Jack Johnson.
Well, Jack had just finished his first year at Michigan, and remember, he'd been drafted number 3 overall.
Yep.
But I think the story goes further than that. I think it was at the draft when Brian Burke was with Anaheim, and Burke wanted to draft him, number 2, but he didn't want him to go to school. Mm-hmm. And this is what I get from Jack. And so Jack said, no, I can't wait to go to school. I'm going to school. And he said, well, we're not going to draft you then. And Jack said, well, that's fine. And so he didn't, and Carolina drafted him. But after the end of Jack's first year, Carolina were in the Stanley Cup playoffs, and they called him and wanted him to join the team, and they thought he could play. And Jack was pretty reasonable. He said, you know, I'm just a freshman at Michigan. Like, I'm not ready to play in the NHL playoffs, Stanley Cup playoffs. Mm-hmm. And they were disappointed in him for that, but Jack was right. It wouldn't have been fair for him. He wasn't ready to step in and displace another NHL defenseman after his first year at Michigan. So, I think Rutherford was disappointed, but I think Jack made the right call. Now, a year later, they traded him to L.A., and L.A. picked him up, and they signed him after his sophomore year. And he was more ready then. And, you know, I don't know if you're ever NHL ready when you're coming out of college after 1 or 2 years. But Jack had a lot of skill, and he was probably too good for college hockey at that time.
Fantastic stuff. Red, this has been a delight. I know you have to get off to the Mike Knuble celebration as he goes into the Grand Rapids Sports Hall of Fame. Thanks for parking a little bit of time for us here on our podcast. It's much appreciated, and best of luck with the Wolverines the rest of the way this year.
Good. Well, thanks, guys, and stay in touch, okay?
Yep, we will. Thanks, Red.
Yep. Okay, bye.
The legendary Red Berenson, Michigan Wolverines head coach.